Welcome to On the Brink Radio. This is broadcast number 205, being recorded here. I'm in Darwin, the Northern Territory of Australia, and we've got Stuart the Effect Simonson, the very doctor himself, joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, down in the deep south, where they say, hi, y'all. Man, it's so good to talk with you again.
Hey, thanks, Jeff. Good talking to you.
And I want to thank you for all your previous interviews and the amazing work that you're doing and all the brilliant graphics and information that you really came out with in the advent of the war games in New Zealand there back in the
Yes, indeed. That's the sound of beautiful ocean
but
waves breaking on the shore
you've been
the
doing. You said you've been working with an electric
I'm not actually near the ocean.
I'm
standing in
just
almost waist-deep water
connection with
here at Rocky Bay, Magnetic Island, Queensland. This is Jeff Weberson. This is On the Brink Radio's very special report in honor of World Ocean Day tomorrow. On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 204. Welcome. I'd like to begin the show by first thanking my beautiful friend, Jaya Earthchild of Hobart, Tasmania. She's been letting me borrow her very sweet little Vixia sort of miniature video camera for the past few months, and this has made it very easier for me to record video and audio in remote locations, and much easier to carry it on my bicycle to go down to the places where I am now, as opposed to carrying my big sort of dinosaurian Sony mini DV tape camera. Thanks, Shaya. And as soon as she gets her camera back, she's going to be recording a brand new song that she's been working on about the Great Barrier Reef, which coincidentally is I'm basically at the edge of the Great Barrier Reef right now. But tomorrow is the annual World Ocean Day, and it's probably something concocted by the United Nations and that kind of thing. But to me, just like for me, every day is Christmas, every day is Earth Day, every day is World Ocean Day for me. I try to go swimming in the ocean every day if I can, and I've been so lucky during my past few weeks on Magnetic Island here, or as the Walgoodoo couple people call it, Yunbanu. It's become my very favorite beach in Australia. I've been able to swim here at least once a day, every day for the past several weeks.
You said
yesterday morning I came here before
sunrise. Put out X
so it's a very special place right now. The tide is pretty low,
environment.
But I've got beautiful
same time
sunshine
the
on my back, even though it's
these same
2 weeks before the winter solstice. It's probably about 28 degrees centigrade, or maybe 75 degrees Fahrenheit. Very beautiful. This show is along the lines of the majority of shows that I've had since 2012 with On the Brink Radio. And again, I'd like to thank Jules Stanley at UCY-TV for her ongoing work and support. And most of my shows have been about issues related to the whales and dolphins and the health of Mother Ocean. And I'll mention a few basic sort of general ideas about Mother Ocean here in the beginning. But the majority of this show is going to be in honor of 10 Kaitiakis Moana. That means guardians of the ocean. Kaitiaki is a Maori name that means guardian.
I've just come from being in the region of the Great Barrier Reef for about 2 months there on Magnetic Island. And I sort of attempted to try to find out who some of the more
most of whom are alive now,
marine researchers might be,
and most of whom I
open
personally know
to hearing this kind of thinking.
Who and have
even
done
though
and are
Terry
doing
put me on to a couple of the graduate
most
students from Australia that are down there over there working with them now.
And real
no one could come up with anyone that
on
they
behalf
thought
of Mother
be
Ocean and all of
hearing her this kind of thing. Because you know, for various reasons and stuff. And,
work
but you know,
research
like,
and activism that really matters is making real contributions that makes a difference. Not just gratuitous social media
playground
let's
for the US
pretend like
Navy
we're saving
military
this or that.
Because as Terry said, the even though the environmental
kind of
regulations
because there's heaps of that out
in America, they still exist to a degree.
And
it really just makes the Navy have to
using English, which is a symbolic language used by humans,
they do, but still
I am constrained by shifting all this medium.
Down under because there's no protection
since,
down here.
Unlike with a visual
and, you know,
image,
the
I can't convey all this information at once.
Their claims that it's
I'm
climate change
forced
that's causing
to
all the delineate and stuff.
The names of these people in a linear sequence.
And, you know, you guys, you
this
and Terry,
sequence
you really
does not reflect
come down here
the importance or significance of these people to me or as to how I see their work. They're all pretty equal. It's just that I can't say all of their names at once. And I guess I could do it alphabetically, but I was probably going to do it in order of sort of the people that have been around the longest. But first, I'd like to just observe that if you look at my blog, Synthesons, and I'll put the link in my blog posting for this show, there's a chapter from a really brilliant book called The Lure of the Dolphin by Robin Brown in the late 1970s. And this is the last chapter of the book, and it's called Coda. And what it is, it's basically his interpretation of what the dolphins would say to us.
That
again, it's not about the exact words, but about the meaning they would convey. First, they contrast the difference between living on land and living in the ocean, and not just the fact that they're relatively free from gravity, but in terms of
it works for a greenhouse.
The surface area of the Earth is approximately 197 million square miles, of which 139 million square miles is water. This is just the surface area, so that's a very big percentage, 70 or more percent. But because the dolphins aren't constrained to the surface, they are able to access the entire three-dimensional cubic volume of the ocean. And that's where their available territory expands exponentially beyond us strictly surface-limited beings. We can go up in the air a little bit and down in the ocean, but not without external technology. The average depth of the ocean is over 12,000 feet. But the cubic volume of the ocean is, get this, 331 million cubic miles. That is a lot of water. But yet, the whales and dolphins are pretty much all the beings that live in the ocean can theoretically go anywhere in that at any time.
Yes.
So that's why Robin Brown says that
between those two,
one of the biggest differences between the whales and dolphins sociocultural and behavioral
repertoire, the total number of vessels in operation at any given time.
But they're so different from us is that they don't really have the concept of territory.
Where they're going and what kind of stuff they're
putting out. Along with many other things, they don't have toothpaste.
In terms of electrical processes,
napkins,
any time
toilet paper,
resistance.
But they don't have territory. They sort of,
I don't know if you'd say resistance is created.
I mean, who knows how they think
the electrical circuit is experiencing.
But they certainly don't divide up territories. They don't have the piece of ocean that they, where they stand the ground. And they might have areas where they tend to hang out. But I don't know if that's probably not totally true, but there might maybe, you know, crabs and organisms that live down at the bottom that'll defend the little area where they have. But in general, the free-roaming pelagic marine mammals and fish and stuff probably really don't have the concept of territory.
It's a very good conductor. You know, recently it's not as good as copper.
I hesitate to guess how many species of life are known to exist in the ocean. There would probably be tens of thousands. But I do know that there's approximately 90 different species of whales and dolphins, the cetaceans.
I've
just been reading a document by the U.S. Navy, which is kind of like a justification for their new budget. Their new catch acronym is called Maritime Domain Awareness. And it's obviously a subset of the whole full spectrum dominance paradigm. But it's just very interesting how they phrase, they basically sum up the way that the whole modern Western world looks at the ocean. They don't see Mother Ocean as a fellow being. They don't see all the beings that live in the ocean as fellow beings. They see them as resources for possibly, at best, animals and plants to be conserved. That's another good one that goes along with robust, is conserving something.
Well, so now tell us about the electrical engineer you've been working with.
It's almost just as abstract as the concept of saving something. Like, we're going to save the whales, we're going to save the dolphins. I still don't really understand what that means. I think the implication is that people intend, or they think that they're taking action somehow, or paying someone else to take action to protect something, but to save it doesn't really make sense. But in the world of today, save and also tell. You know, like you see this in mass media, social media, a lot of it goes like, save the whales or tell the evil oil companies that they're destroying the life of the whales. But the translation of save and tell in that context really means give us money, give donations to our organization, Greenpeace or whoever, and we'll save the whales and tell the politicians and the oil companies, we'll do that for you. I just don't buy into that whole way of doing things. I've been reading a very interesting book lately. It's called The Deep Hot Biosphere by an astronomer named Thomas Gold. I believe he's dead now, but he was a very, very, very major figure. He was, I believe, head of the astronomy department at Cornell University, and this will tell you how big of a bigwig he was. He actually hired Carl Sagan. He gave Carl Sagan his first job as an astronomer on the staff of Cornell, though, there back in probably the 1950s or 1960s. Anyway, he's sort of a renegade mind that has invaded other scientific disciplines and solved very perplexing problems in all of these disciplines, often pissing off a lot of people because he overturned their apple cart by figuring stuff out that they had never been able to figure out or that they didn't want to deal with. And he's almost all the time been right. But this book, I strongly recommend it, The Deep Hot Biosphere, because it's about the idea that life originally originated not even in the ocean, but down deep in the crust of the earth, in the crevices between the rocks, tiny little microbes that don't need sunlight and didn't need photosynthesis, that they actually derived their energy from the hydrocarbons, and this is another important part of this book, from the hydrocarbons that occur, are created from geochemical processes deep, deep, deep down in the Earth's mantle. This is the whole abiogenic hydrocarbon idea that Russian scientists have known for many, many, many decades. Now I'll begin by talking about these 10 Kaitiakis Moana. First, I'm going to start with Dr. Roger Payne. He is the guy, he and Ian Kerr founded an organization called Ocean Alliance back in the 1970s, which I consider to be one of, if not the top true fair dinkum oceanic research organizations in the world. And they've been really nice to me. They consider me to be their Southern Hemisphere correspondent. Roger Payne, the thing that I think he's most famous for is that in the early 1970s, he and another scientist friend named Scott McVeigh were out in boats studying humpback whale songs. But back then they weren't called songs, they were just called their noises or their sounds. But both of them being musicians, I think Roger Payne plays cello and Scott McVeigh another instrument, but they recognized the sounds of the humpback whales as being songs or music. So this was a very, very important recognition and resulted in a very interesting paper published in Nature magazine in 1973. So I'd like to thank Dr. Roger Payne for his brilliant work of many, many decades of working on behalf of the whales and dolphins. And another thing that Ocean Alliance has done is to conduct a 5-year global survey of ocean toxicity in their sailboat research yacht Odyssey. Yes. Back from like 2005 to 2010. And then they went down and did two or more studies of what's happened in the Gulf of Mexico in the wake of the BP oil spill disaster. This is truly very important work. Right now, I'd like to also mention, as number two, Ian Kerr, Dr. Ian Kerr, who also co-founded Ocean Alliance with Roger Payne. Now, Ian, I've interviewed him on my radio show last year. And tomorrow, his wife Amy just sent a message and said that he has been invited to speak at the World Ocean Day ceremony at the United Nations with all these really big wig people. And it's Dr. Sylvia Earle is going to be talking there along with James Cameron, the movie making dude from New Zealand. And so this is a really big and important event for them. They've been using these drones called snotbots to collect exhaled mucus samples from whales in several different areas, Argentina, Alaska, I'm not sure where else. And then they're going to study these mucus samples to see what the hormone levels tell them about the stress levels of the whale.
Yes.
So this could be very interesting. The Ocean Alliance used to work with Dr. John Wise, who I'm also trying to line up to do an interview with. He's a genetic toxicologist in Louisville, Kentucky now. Number three, I'll mention Dr. Sylvia Earle. Now, I don't really know all that much about her, but she is a major oceanic big wing type person. The thing I know best about her is a couple of years ago, she came out with this really cool article about why she's been a vegetarian, if not even a vegan, for decades, and why she doesn't eat fish. And it's a brilliant,
the answer is clear,
comprehensive look at the whole concept of why. Of course, she doesn't have to explain why fish is meat, but she explains why we shouldn't be eating fish, or really anything from the ocean for that matter, for several different reasons. And I think that's a brilliant idea. I'd like to mention who is now Dr. Wally Franklin of the Byron Bay area in New South Wales, and his organization called the Oceania Project. Wally and his wife Trish and their son Mark have been doing very remarkable work with humpback whales there on the east coast of Australia for decades. And I did an interview with Wally 2 years ago.
We are. And
he's a really fantastic person. They've done some amazing recordings of the humpback whales there in Harvey Bay every year. How about the name Jacques Cousteau?
Or microwave transmitter.
Now, everybody knows who he was. He was the French guy. And his son and sons and daughter. I think one of his sons died in an accident somehow. But his other son, Philippe, and his daughter are sort of carrying on his tradition. But I remember seeing his shows on TV when I was a kid. John Denver, the musician, did a really cool song called Calypso about Jacques Cousteau's research festival. But he did lots of, he brought the underwater biosphere to the homes of probably tens or hundreds of millions of people because of his television shows. As I understand it, the legendary Sir Peter Blake of New Zealand, he was a skipper of the yacht that won the America's Cup a couple of times, but then he, because of his travels around the world, he had seen so much environmental damage being done that he devoted the rest of his life to trying to ameliorate and study this environmental damage. And he, I believe, bought this very special boat that Jacques Cousteau had built. That it was a boat with a retractable rudder that was able to go up river mouths into very, very shallow water.
Constantly fluctuating,
and it was on this boat they were doing a sting operation up in the mouth of the Amazon River along with the Greenpeace boat to try to catch these organized crime people that were illegally logging mahogany and then floating it down the river. And that's when he got shot in defense of his crew. So these were very serious oceanographic people. I'd like to mention my beautiful friends at Stranded No More, who are a coalition of marine biologists based in somewhere in Hawaii now. But they do very amazing work on behalf of cetacean reality in terms of monitoring stranding events all around the world, and correlating them with seismic testing, hazardous military industrial operations, and
yes,
with almost every stranding event that happens, these correlations are there. They also spend a lot of energy documenting the basic failure of the whole Western
computer program.
Cetacean rescue operations.
Use all existing
now that it's much easier and likely for a stranded whale to be euthanized than it is
exactly
to be rescued in the West. It seems like
any
the most successful
at any given time.
Rates of cetacean rescue are in sort of less developed countries where it's not an industry. Stranded No More creates these brilliant sort of graphic map chart images that show all this information. I'd like to mention my friend Douglas Webster, Douglas Dolphinus, who lives on the Big Island of Hawaii. And I'd like to thank him for his ongoing support. He hosts my website on his website called DolphinMatrix.com. he's spent decades swimming with dolphins there off of the Kona area and works with this woman named Joan Ocean and other whale and dolphin people there.
All these things.
Done a couple of interviews with him. I'd like to thank my friend Kaitiaki Moana Glenn Edney of New Zealand, who I met a few months ago. And I've interviewed him, I think, four times. He and his wife, Jamie, are doing some very brilliant work. And he's got his book published, and they're sort of launching
Well, let me ask you this. Could this work for a
dimension of their work out through this?
The ocean?
It's a website called Patreon. I haven't checked it out yet, but I'll put a link on this posting where you can support his work financially. But they're doing some very important work, I think, focusing on the plastic issue a lot lately. Not last, second to last, but way up there in importance is my friends Dr. Terry, Mr. Limpet Lilly, and Stuart the Effect Simonson, who I've been interviewing them a lot over the past few months. Terry's a marine biologist and underwater photographer in Hawaii.
And
Stuart is a chemical engineer working in Atlantis, Georgia. But they've worked together and independently to monitor the effects of microwaves and electromagnetic radiation, especially in the marine environment and shipping lanes and the electrification of the hulls of boats. And Terry spent massive amounts of energy documenting the effects of the U.S. Navy's microwave installation on Kauai and how it killed off all the corals there. But then when they stopped doing it, the corals have come back. But now, apparently, the military's back in full force on Kauai, even worse than ever, because of the Pacific pivot. And Terry reckons that they're now going to turn Hawaii into an offensive missile base facility. So it's just all of the military industrial civilization stuff is just running off the rail. But these guys are doing some very important work and gradually carving out a niche to get this information onto the radar of the people that are pretty much obsessed with climate change as being the cause of everything. Now, last, and probably by orders of magnitude, the most important guardian of Mother Ocean to me and one of my biggest heroes of all time is the scientist, author, naturalist Rachel Carson, who wrote three brilliant books about the ocean: Under the Sea Wind, The Sea Around Us, and At the Edge of the Sea, before she wrote her fourth book that really catapulted her into the limelight called Silent Spring, about the global pesticide scenario. But she has inspired me so much that I don't know if anyone else has been such a beautiful combination of scientist and someone who truly loves nature and understands the non-human world, and who has the ability to express these feelings and ideas in a truly literary format. And her messages from the 1950s and 60s are as relevant today as they ever were. That's probably pretty much all I have to say for this show. It's so nice to sit here listening to the sound of the ocean.
It's very bad for biology. You know, if you put chlorine into the seawater or in your swimming pool, you know, you start killing off living creatures. You basically sterilize.
It's ironic that this is a talk radio show, and I spend so much time and energy trying to communicate about the limitations of our linguistic behavioral mode that we tend to stay on all the time. That's why I try to get in as much nonverbal talk radio as I can with music and the sounds of birds and whales and dolphins and nature and all her different forms. Music, the music of the spheres.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask you this. What do you know about the adverse effects of life forms as a whole?
Please go out and know that it's be with good. Mother Ocean.
Ever since the dawn,
not only today and tomorrow, but every day, if you can.
Moira Thames, go and get wet. Translate some ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics.
When I take a shower, I try to get swimming in the ocean as soon as possible after my shower so I can have the salt water on my body rather than vice versa, like most people do.
The closest thing
the ocean is the ultimate solution.
So I've used the hieroglyph for lightning in my
she really is
when I needed that.
A beautiful, beautiful
and
being,
of
and there's
natural,
only one of her.
But tell us
one
the
mother
difference
ocean
between,
the whole
electrically,
planet.
Between a bolt of lightning.
We can't really understand who and what she is.
Current or voltage at the same power level generated.
But she's the home too.
How would they differ?
The vast majority of our family of life are Mother Earth.
A little bit. Lightning is, it can be about a terawatt pulse.
I don't have to go out
okay,
on a boat to be with her.
So the amount of
especially not a boat that's chopping through the water with propellers.
Right,
I admire people that go out in sailboats. But I like being on the water, but I don't have to. And I love the whales and dolphins, but I don't have to go out there and actually physically be with them to understand who they are and to communicate with them in many kinds of ways. It is nice to be with someone that's your friend. But I think humans go to such extremes to put themselves in environments where I'm not going to say that we don't belong there, but if you have to go to great technological extremes and expenditures of energy and resources in order to be somewhere, I'm not sure how much sense that makes from a truly ecological perspective. This is Jeff Weberson. Thanks for listening. Enjoy World Ocean Day. Try to live simply so that others may simply live. Constantly try to reprogram and re-navigate to your very highest point. Signing off for On the Brink Radio.
Radars, if you look at that impulse map, they're popping the area with military base like that.
This is a flute song for Mother Ocean.
It's popping a hell of a lot.
All our family of life in
the 1,000 times a second. You know, it's similar to getting hit with lightning.
But it's a slightly different frequency, right?
Well, but the effect is the same. Microwaves do two things. They can heat you up, but they also trigger electrical currents in conductors, right? Any electrical voltage potential, it will induce electrical currents. So, same way that lightning, which is, discharging at the speed of light, triggers electrical currents. These high-gain antennas do the same thing.
Yes.
They trigger electrical currents in the body. Very sensitive to it.
Absolutely. We're very sensitive. Well, let me ask you this. I've learned in my research about microwaves that the Soviet Union was very far ahead on, even in the 1930s. They realized that you've got what they call the thermal model, the level of microwaves at which heating occurs, but then they've got the biological model, which is 1,000 times lower, the level at which it's deleterious to biological life forms. And would that lower level be because of exactly what you just said, because of triggering electrical currents and highly conductive life forms?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, our bodies they work off electrical impulses, right? I mean, that's how your muscles move, so.
Very small ones.
Yeah, and so, yeah, absolutely. Very sensitive to it. And, the military, they want to own the spectrum and roll the airwaves and all that. And I think they're completely close to the place of radiation.
Well, I think that
which public isn't even aware because you can't see it, and the effects are wide-ranging effects, but hard to pin down. Right?
Yes, and one of the most powerful sources of electromagnetic radiation going into people's eyes and brains called television. The messages on there are constantly telling people that all this stuff is okay, and that they need it because it's protecting them against the evil enemies, like the North Korean guy. Are you getting a lot of that North Korean stuff over there?
Do I believe it?
No, I mean, are you getting a lot of it in the media?
Trump, he's gotten so stirred up on everything, so that's one of the sidelines.
Well, that's stirring is just a precursor to flushing. Maybe his bowl will get flushed. But I think the big bowl is going to get flushed on all of us, as we've talked about before. I wanted to ask you about just the effects of, for example, being in a house that's wired with alternating current. And can you describe the different biological effects if, for example, Thomas Edison had his way and the whole electrical system was direct current? rather than the alternating current that was invented by Tesla. The direct current doesn't flicker back and forth. Describe the difference between a direct current and alternating current and what the different biological effects would be.
So alternating current, at least in the U.S., is like 60 hertz or so. So it oscillates, up and down 60 times a second. And it usually is three phase, so you have three phases that are all cycling up and down 60 times a second. Now, what they say is that because it's oscillating, anytime you have a changing electric current, you induce magnetic fields, right? Anytime you vary the electrical current changes, the strength of the magnetic field changes, and a changing magnetic field can induce an electric field. So you get more noise around AC currents. When I say noise, that means if you're near wiring or near the outlet, it gives off some EMF.
But let me ask you this. So with direct current, if it's constant, it's not generating a magnetic field?
So it is, but it's not changed. So if the current stays constant,
yes,
it's generating a much lower magnetic field.
Okay. Just because of the motion of the electrons.
Yeah, because an alternating current is changing 60 times a second.
But why does it do that? I mean, what's the advantage of having an alternating current? Why would Tesla have preferred that over DC?
It's easy to generate alternating current, right, with a spinning turbine generator. We use turbine generators to generate the power, so you spin magnets around a conductor, you induce electrical charge. So I think it's on the power generation side, I think it's easier to generate our whole system set up by electromagnetic induction, which is reducing electric currents in copper wire. I use thick turbo generators, spin magnets around coils.
Well, I know that solar panels generate DC, right?
Yeah, they have to go through an inductor that converts it to DC power to project it to the 60 hertz power lines. And like I said, I think it's more got to do with the generator. So it's easier to generate AC.
So it's an engineering issue.
Yeah, you just spin magnets around a conductor and you can induce electrical current. That's how a turbine generator works, and that's how most of our power is generated. Whereas, like you said, solar power would be direct current, like a battery, like a solar type battery could be DC.
Yes.
That's a good answer.
Well, that was good. Let me ask you this: did you hear of or did we talk about the Schumann resonance?
Of the natural frequency of the Earth.
Yes, it's about the same as the what we call the alpha wave rhythm of our brain.
Yeah, and it's fairly low frequency, right?
I think it's about about 7 hertz in that range.
Yeah, and the problem, I think, all this artificial man-made radiation in the gigahertz range and megahertz, they're not natural frequencies, for one. Number two is now it's all gone digital, so now you have all this pulsed radiation, which has these sharp edges to the pulses. And, like I said, anytime you're pulsing or varying an electric field up and down quickly, you're inducing magnetic fields and electrical currents in conductors. So
analog electricity is safer than digital.
That's right.
There you go.
I think nature operates at the speed of light. In other words, your body senses it, right? If you've got electrolytes, they sense that high frequency change. Now you may not visually your brain may not be able to sense it real well, but your body is sensing it. And it probably treats it like it's not my fault or anything either, but it doesn't know what it is. You know, it doesn't know how to respond to an impulsive,
exactly, and I'd like to draw a contrast here because life on Mother Earth has evolved and grown in the presence of all kinds of incoming cosmic radiation and influences and stuff, and some of it may be essential for our very existence, but we've adapted to being here, and we've got the time frame and the atmosphere to filter out a lot of the UV rays and cosmic rays and different kind of things like that. But would you say that the sum effect of all the stuff on life is that we're a giant experiment in self-induced mutation?
Yeah, I actually exactly think that's what's happening. We're speeding up the mutation. You know, cancer is basically mutations, right? Cells and DNA, so...
Well, yes, once maladaptive mutations. Most mutations are not biologically successful.
That's right, most of them aren't, and, you know, the host gets cancer and it dies or whatever, or becomes unhealthy, so... So, yeah, I think we are increasing the rate of mutations by all this EMF we're pumping out 24/7.
Yes, and not only on us, but on all of life on Mother Earth, and not just the EMF, but all the other synergically interacting variables like the radiological nuclear scenario, the chemical toxicity, all these different things, even like sonar and noise would figure in too.
And there's really no, as we got looking in North Carolina here, the government organizations, they're not policing it very well. You know, even the oceans. NOAA got sued in California because they, the federal judge said, "You guys, your take off whales and all that, you underplayed the amount of damage the military could do."
But of course, they're a branch of the Navy. What do you expect? Just like Scripps. They work for the Navy. That's their job, is to admit that this stuff exists, but then to play it down to say it's all at safe levels.
Even the EPA, they're not monitoring this stuff, so
no.
They don't have a clue.
They use their computer simulations. Our computer simulations.
And the military has a clue, but they don't speak honestly about it. And they're covered by NOAA, and like you said, these organizations that are basically
PR branches.
Military-industrial complex.
Well, I really think that there's people at the Pentagon and some of these agencies and stuff that are doing they know they're in charge of the dirty work that all this stuff is doing on behalf of the international banking cartel, and I'm not going to invoke conspiracies theory or the Illuminati or anything like that, but I do think that there's solid evidence. For example, in this chapter called The Brotherhood of Death by William Engdahl, a very brilliant German researcher who, his book The Seeds of Destruction about genetic engineering, he talks about the mentality behind the whole sort of global depopulation agenda that's been very central in American controlling the secret government all through the 20th century. What they used to call it eugenics, which was like a euphemism, but I think that they know what all this stuff is doing.
Yeah, I think they do. But unless the body count is high enough, they really don't deal with it. Public really wants to wake up and do something about it, it won't change.
Well, let me ask you this. This is touching on something that we've talked about before. I personally think, and I'm just throwing this out and asking what you think, I think that we do not have the ability to turn all this shit off anymore. I think even if the highest level of people all wanted all this stuff to stop, they couldn't do it. There's no way. It has a mind of its own. You can map out all kinds of different ways that this is the reality. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's so intertwined in our society now. And the power base of governments, let's face it, World War II was won, they say, a big part because of the radar. And so these electronics that have come out of the military, industrial complex, they're now pervasive, and I think it allows basically what Eisenhower warned everybody against. And then you've got academic institutions under the government, the military. So I think that, you know, it's going to be hard now to say you can't do it. You know, I don't want to be a completely jaded or cynical.
But that's it. The best way we can improve would be to get rid of all this stuff so we can return to being biological organisms again. But what about the whole, you know the letters AI, how big that is in all the technocratic circles now, artificial intelligence, that the concept's been around for decades, but it's this big sort of trendy thing. But do you think it's possible that this vastly interconnected electro-computerized system, of course, the whole electrical grid is just a part, but it's all run by computers and simulations and stuff, that it's developed I hesitate to use the word mind, but sort of an emergent awareness of its own that's not going to allow itself to be shut down. Could that be possible? And it's sort of, it doesn't really dwell in any certain, and it's not in any certain computer. It's like a distributed, I'm not going to use the word intelligence. These are all very totally anthropocentric terms, but Dr. John Lilly actually thought that he was witnessing a battle here between what he called the solid state entity and water-based life, and it was targeting the whales and dolphins because they were the ones that had the strongest connection to water-based life coming into Mother Earth from other planets and other star systems, and that the solid state entity was using us below our level of awareness to construct it so it could wage war on life until the time came when it didn't need us anymore. And I think if looking at this whole scenario, that time is at hand.
Yeah, I think what's driven it is money and power. You know, to maintain a power base, you have to have a strong military, and
how many
money flows through it?
How many watts would this power be? How many watts would this power be? It would be pico watts.
It's green. It's at the green level. So I think that's what's driven it. I don't think, I worked with lots of computers. I used to work for Honeywell, actually, on a computer company in Silicon Valley. Computers are somewhat dumb, but the programming behind them is getting better and better. So I don't worry about them. I worry about, like these weather radars. I mean, they're computer driven, right? They show you nice, pretty graphics with a cute girl on a weather channel. But what they don't tell you, what you're actually seeing, is radiation, right? You watch the doppler weather on 6 o'clock news. Yeah, I'm seeing that. You're actually seeing the radiation bouncing off the clouds, penetrating the walls of your house.
Most people don't realize that.
They just see the green, pink, and red. So, the storm's coming. Well, that's actually the radiation bouncing off the storm, getting absorbed by you and your children. So, it's our use of the technology, right? And, it's all military-driven technology. Most of the research has come out of that. So,
what do you know about satellites?
So, the broadcast, the whole broadcast industry is satellite-based, right? Telecommunications.
But they all use microwaves, don't they?
Yeah, it's all gigahertz microwave radiation, and that's why, look at my maps, my paper on the autism cluster in Hollywood, California. That's the microwave broad satellite broadcast center of the country, right? They've got 224 high-gain, 10-meter satellite broadcast antennas that beam a microwave beam up through the atmosphere to a satellite. And then a DirecTV satellite or whoever it is broadcasts that down to your dish at your house or at the local cable station.
Yes.
So, where I think the problem is that the transmitters, which is, 224 of them are right there in Hollywood. It's the microwave broadcast capital world. That's all gigahertz radiation.
Yes.
And, you know, the thing about the atmosphere is it scatters that radiation. But what they do is they oversize the antenna power levels to take care of what gets scattered.
Yes.
They make it more powerful than it needs to be.
Exactly. Let me ask you this. Could you create a diagram that shows, for example, all the transmitters there in North Hollywood, that shows visual, like little lines, that shows where the main emphasis of each transmitter is going, like up to show a line that goes to each of the satellites it's going to, and then show lines that show where the lines from each of those satellites is going, whether it's to other satellites or down to other transmitters, you know, just coming out of Hollywood there. Could you do that? Because I think it would be scary.
There's also microwave relay towers that transmit from studios up to a mountaintop. You know, that's a horizontal beam of radiation that transfers maybe 3 to 5 miles from the studio to a main antenna up on the mountaintop and then rebroadcasts it. So those lines are already showing up on my map, and then I locate the satellite transmitters, but I don't show the line from the transmitter up to the satellite.
Yes, there will be a diagram that will show the surface angles and suborbital, low orbital space.
What I gotta do is, you know, there's multiple satellites up there in geostationary orbit, so I've got to. I've already thought of doing exactly what you said, is just show those beam paths. Now, the other thing is, the problem, I think, in the area is we've got 3 busy airports, so as those planes fly over those beams, and you don't. Instead of putting 1 antenna in an area, they put 15 or 20. So now all these beams are going up to a satellite, and now you have a plane fly between the transmitter and the satellite, and all that microwave radiation reflects back to the ground.
And that's happening all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and that would be everywhere, though, too, but especially concentrated there.
That's where you have these high-gain transmitter dishes broadcasting, and you have air traffic overhead.
Well, you've got, like Terry says, in Kauai, they have the no-fly zones around all the microwave dishes there.
Yeah, well, and it's because, well, I've already done calculations that the antenna's at 2,000 feet over the ocean. If you have an airplane or a helicopter fly overhead, and that beam is reflecting off it, you get thousands of watts per meter squared, or 1,000 volts per meter hitting the surface of the ocean. And then the ocean has to dissipate that electrical charge. And that's happening over and over and over. And I told them that's why I think the cliffs are all red on there, because you've oxidized the iron in the cliffs. And that's why your reef is turning orange and red and dying down below.
Well, let me ask you this. You said that dude assembled that measurement gear with the spectrum analyzers and stuff, and he was studying it. Would it be possible to take some of that with a plane and fly through the microwave beams over Hollywood and get some measurements?
Sure.
That would be useful, wouldn't it?
I don't think you have to fly. Just drive around in a car near the airport. The autism cluster wraps right around the airport.
But would it be the same at ground level as what's going up to the satellites?
Yeah, you know, these planes are coming in and out of the airports at just a couple thousand feet in the air, okay? So the microwave radiation isn't going very far. It's going a couple thousand feet up and then a couple thousand feet back to the ground.
When's the last time you went to North Hollywood?
When's the last time I went there?
Yeah, in person. Well, dude, because of all this, the people would have to be looking weird there now, wouldn't they?
Well, look at Nick Nolte. He's aged pretty quickly.
I don't watch media. Mass media.
Yeah.
This is the source of all the mutated-looking space creatures that come out of Hollywood.
Yeah, it's the reason I don't think there's any good movies coming out of Hollywood.
Well, look, tell us about what exactly is the 5G network. What is that?
You know, all it is a way to transfer, you know, get more bandwidth, right? So they're put more pulse power. It's all digital now, so you're pulsing higher amounts of power and with digital pulses, and so you can transmit more information. But in the end, I think nature treats all this stuff just like a voltage potential, and it has to dissipate and get just were turning up the intensity of this radiation, right?
Yes.
So our kids can stream YouTube videos through their heads.
And watch sport. The adults watch sport. Hey, but look, let me ask you this. Pulling back to what I was eventually hoping to get to, and we'll have to do it in the next interview, but if you were Mother Earth, and you were experiencing, because Mother, like, you're as a person, we're each aware of every point in our body. If something, if a pin pricks you anywhere, you know it. If you get burned anywhere on your body, you know it and feel it, and inside you, on the surface of your skin, you have feelings and awarenesses and somatic sensations. And I think Mother Earth, we can't possibly understand a planet, but she is a living being that has given birth to all of life as we know her, and we're only one of her children. But I think that what I'm trying to do is pull back and try to visualize how Mother Earth is experiencing us and our impacts and presence. And I think normally, as we're normally supposed to be, as sort of like indigenously living people in harmony, we're like little flocks of little pets, little flowers and little nice little amoebas running around on her surface. But we've become this virulent, invasive, tumorous cancer with all these really weird technologies, electrical stuff and radiation and chemical stuff, and having effects on her all over her body, in the ocean, on the land, all the mine sites, every suburban area, all the highways, all the electrical transmission stuff, the nuclear waste dumps, the military industrial presence, the techno genius presence of all the stuff. And I think that we're hurting her, and that she's very aware. She would be simultaneously, just like, if you had a million pins sticking in you all over your body, you'd have a three-dimensional map in your brain of those pains going off. And I think Mother Earth has that. I think that she's feeling all the different stuff that we're doing that's hurting her at every different point at any given moment in time. And to try to understand what we're putting her through and how it's, I think, physically as well as spiritually impossible that it's going to be, that it's going to keep going for long, because we're destroying the being that gives us life.
Yeah. So my take is we're more like a bunch of fire ants on the surface, right? I like it, humans more of fire ants.
Yeah, but they don't have radiation and microwaves and laser beams and mines.
Yeah, but they're aggressive and they attack and they.
But they're not. They don't attack Mother Earth. They just attack other life forms. We're attacking the planet herself.
Yeah, so I think everything's connected, Jeff, right? I'm a believer that we're all connected to nature, okay? I honestly think that, there's intelligence in the universe, and that it actually looks at human race and laughs at us. In other words, I think if anything, it's, I won't say ambivalent, but it almost laughs at it, because we're being really ignorant with our children and our environment. And I think if and when humans are gone, I think Earth will do just fine without us. I think it did fine without us for billions of years before we showed up.
Yes, and the climate changed as well.
I think the climate, readjusts itself, and it goes, it cycles up and down, and we happen to live in this slice of time where it's conducive to our type of life, and that won't necessarily last, and we may speed it along, right? I think, we may, if a nuclear war were to break out, who knows where that could go.
Could you call this the electriferous era?
I think looking back, people are gonna look at this, if we're still around, and say, it was a very
a long, strange trip.
Yeah, it was a. I think for our children and health, a very dark period. I think it's gonna be looked at that way, and what we did to the Earth, our coastlines, the marine life. Just the value that we put on life, including including our own, if it doesn't change, I don't think we'll last that long. And I think the Earth's going to land. I think she'll be around. And, you know, the universe will do just fine.
Absolutely. But absolutely.
I don't think we have the power to kill the Earth.
No, absolutely not. But she's let us live this long. But it keeps, nothing's in...
learn our own lessons now, how quickly we want to learn them, and what to deny them. I think we're in this period, you know, I do think most of what you see on TV is propaganda.
Oh, that's far too kind.
You can't even watch the news, CNN and the Fox, it's mostly propaganda.
Well, that's all, but it's highly weaponized, but you're still getting the flickering electromagnetic signals from the medium itself. But look, Stuart, let me ask you this. We've only got a minute or two left. You want to kind of sum up everything. We've concluded an interview before saying that, like, the giant comet is probably already on its way. And, but you know, if we use that as a metaphor for the healing of Kuranaskatsi, which has to happen, you know, I don't think that humanity, our true nature is not bad, but it's what we've mutated into ever since the dawn of what we call civilization. We've mutated into beings that, in general, really don't even resemble what we were really supposed to be. It's Mickey.
It's Mickey Mouse. I don't think it's really supportive of, life.
No. Au contraire. It's life's greatest enemy.
And I think the sad thing is our children are and will continue to suffer from that. And how you break out of it,
Well, maybe we're going through everything that we're experiencing now is palliative care.
But, you know, there's different stages of denial, right? There's five stages or whatever, and we're in early stages.
Reality, as we've constructed it, is an active denial system.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of denial and propaganda. They say the first casualty of war is the truth, right?
Absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing.
And I see it as war. I see this whole massive microwave influx as basically part of war.
It is. It is. It's a full-spectrum war against life. But look, we better close for now. Stuart the Effect Simonson, I'll call you sir. Sir Stuart, Sir Effect. Man, I can't tell you how cool it is talking with you. This is Jeff Wilkerson and Stuart Simonson signing off for On the Brink Radio. But Stuart, may we do another interview soon?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thanks, man.
Stay in touch. All right. Thanks a lot.